listening to By the Well, a lectionary-based podcast for preachers recorded on the land of the Wurundjeri people.
We're in the season of Epiphany, or Epiphany Tide as some churches call it, and this week is Epiphany 5. It's a season where the name suggests we celebrate the manifestation of the divine, the way God appears and is made real and revealed in our lives, and we'll see that picked up in various ways in today's readings. I'm Robin Whittaker.
And I'm Howard Wallace.
And it's worth mentioning this week, Howard is one of our new co-hosts, so welcome, Howard.
Thank you very much.
Howard is a retired professor of Old Testament who used to work here at Pilgrim in the University of Divinity. He's written a lot, particularly on the Psalms, but other things as well. And can you just tell us about your lectionary resources page? Because we've put that on our website.
Well, this is a project I started quite a long time ago, and with a team of group people, we developed a responsive, reflective work on the lectionary each week as often as we could. And I've developed that now into a full 3-year cycle.
Fantastic.
So it can be found on the web.
Yeah, it's a great resource for you to, if you just want to go and read a little bit more of reflections on the readings. So this week we're going to discuss all four readings, Isaiah 6, 1-8 and 9-13, Psalm 138, 1 Corinthians 15, 1-11 and Luke 5, 1-11. So we'll start with Isaiah 6. Howard, can you give us a bit of context here, please?
Yes, Isaiah 6 is a passage that's probably well known to a lot of people. We might sort of refer to it as the call of Isaiah when he's called to be a prophet. Although there are some funny things about the placement of this, most calls, like in Jeremiah and Ezekiel, come right at the very beginning of the book, justifying their prophetic utterances and what they had to do. But this one comes when you're into the book itself.
Yep.
Now, the beginning of it may have related to the call of the prophet that we know as Isaiah, who lived in the 7th century, the 8th century started. But it's developed a bit further than that. It sits now not so much just as a call of an individual, but I think it reigns over the whole of the book. So it's an authorization for the prophet's words that are to follow, but they're not all the words of the one prophet. The words in Isaiah go on for centuries.
Yes, so historically it's not one man, but it becomes known as the prophecy of Isaiah.
Yes, yes.
And are there sort of exegetical things we want to note? And we might even begin with, you know, the lectionary gives us an option of verses 1-8 and then in brackets 9-13.
Yes.
Do you think is it important to add those later verses?
Definitely.
Why?
Because I think, 1-8 is familiar. This passage, those first 8 verses also occur in year B in Trinity Sunday, which sort of speaks about the glory of God and God's God the Father in this context, his presence in the heavenly world. That's repeated, of course, in verses 1-8, but then it goes on in 9-13 to speak about the task that the prophet himself has. And unless you understand, I think, the two in relation to each other, you don't really sort of get the sort of sense
of what's going on.
What's going on, yes. Because it starts off talking about God's glory being filling the earth itself. But then we're left with the question of how does God's glory fill the earth? And I think quite deliberately what the book is saying is that it fills the earth through the words of the prophet. And those words are not heard clearly or understood properly, I think, by the people who hear them. And we have to hear that as well.
Yes, it's a difficult prophetic calling when you read the full chapter. Because
you don't really understand prophetic calling unless you understand what the response to the word is, as well as the commission to utter those words.
Yeah. So let's perhaps unpack this a bit. I mean, we've got this vision of glory, and one of the first things I want to say is these seraphim around this sort of this temple. So the temple, if we think of that as perhaps the biggest building people could imagine, and that God's hem or skirt fills it is something expansive and glorious. And then seraphim are fiery and terrifying.
Yes, they come from a Hebrew word, which means to burn.
Yeah. So these are not cute little angels flying around. No. This is, you know, part of the glory of God is also fearsome, I think.
Yes, it's awesome.
And they do the worship. They proclaim this holiness. Mm. And Isaiah, and we're going to see this in different ways in each of our readings today, Isaiah's response to this vision of God's glory is a sense of unworthiness framed here as unclean lips.
Yeah.
Can you say anything about how do you read that sort of...
Well, how I read, I think he's aware of his humanity and his inadequacy in sort of coping with the vision, if you like, or even sort of responding to it in one way or another. And part of that is the note of forgiveness, which is there in the symbolic way of the seraphim touching his lips with a burning coal.
Yeah. I've been reading Robert Alter's translation of the Old Testament, and he actually has for verse 7, "Look, this has touched your lips and your crime is gone," is the way he's translating it. Yeah. Your offence is atoned, which is perhaps stronger language than the NRSV, but...
too strong in my opinion, in some ways. But I think crime sort of brings up images of deliberate wrongdoing on our part. And yet I think what I understand Scripture is talking about when it's talking about human sin is just our human condition.
Yes.
Which is, in a way, I mean, don't want to sound too stark, but it's inadequate for being in the presence of the divine.
Yeah. Yes, so the guilt in the NRSV might be more appropriate for the mistakes we made that are not necessarily
and
willful.
Just our inadequacies, our vulnerability as being human beings. And the point to note is that it's the seraphim, presumably an angel of God acting on God's behalf, touches his lips. It's not him sort of confessing so much that brings upon the forgiveness, but it's the act of God that does that.
Yeah, and again, we're going to see that repeated. There's this sense of unworthiness, but the action to address that is wholly on the part of the divine, not on human activity to somehow fix themselves. Mm. So that's an important theological point. I've always been surprised. This can read as a pretty quick turnaround where we get the "Who shall I send?" and it's like, here I am, Hanani. Yes. And I wonder how we... depending on how you actually read that, can infer a whole lot of things. Is it, "Here I am, me, I'm ready now," or is it like, "Oh, here I am, like there's no one else"? You know, do you have a sense of prophetic reluctance or enthusiasm? Or,
well, I think some of the reluctance emerges in the word that's to follow. I mean, we can read it rather simply and easily, and I think the same question will pop up in relation to the New Testament, the Luke reading. He volunteers, and it seems like a heroic sort of act on his part, a very brave act, but then I think the reality of what it means is what's addressed in those next verses, verses 9 to 13.
Mm. So can you tell us a bit more about what's in there?
What's in... 9 to 13. Well, I mean, it sounds rather strange to our ears in some ways, because it almost sounds as though God is sort of contradicting what we expect God to be doing. You know, speak and these people won't hear.
Yes.
Make them deaf, make their eyes blind, etc., etc. But I think what is going on here is Isaiah is hearing what the full effect of his utterance is going to be like, that people will be against him, that people will not want to hear what he has to say, which is rather interesting in the context of where the passage sits. I mean, it's not only near the beginning of the book and hence, in some sense, an authorization for prophetic words. It's about the Assyrians attacking Israel, which is the context of the next few chapters. And, of course, the Assyrians were the superpower of their day.
Yep.
So Israel, or in this case really Judah's, hopes of surviving any attack by the Assyrians was pretty small.
Yep.
So I think within that context, the reality is that people are not going to listen to these sort of rather savage words about trusting in God in this context.
Yeah, because it is this context of doom and gloom, and in a sense, a lot of what Isaiah does, I mean, there are glimmers of hope even early, but of what Isaiah does is actually foretell destruction.
Yes, it is. And we get that in the chapters immediately preceding this context. Although there are the words of hope, and there's the word of hope that sort of comes through in this passage right at the very end when he's sort of picking up this image of a burnt tree. By saying that the holy seed is in its stump.
Yes.
So there is a sort of sense of hope there, but it will only be really seen and understood once the destruction has come.
Yes.
Once the foolishness and vulnerability of the people has sort of run its course.
Run its course, yep. But that holy seed is there. It's not thoroughly dead.
No, and we don't pick it up again until we get to chapter 11.
Yeah.
With that great passage about a shoot shall come forth.
From the stump of Jesse. Yes, yeah. Some of those more familiar passages. Mm. Anything else you want to say about Isaiah before we move to the psalm?
Just that I think it's a passage that is immensely relevant in the present day context. I mean, we're far from the historical context that might lie behind it. But, you know, when we're in a church that has many small and ageing congregations who ask questions about how do we regenerate our life together, I mean, I think this is a word that sort of speaks to us today when Christianity is questioned and threatened in some ways.
And declining in its traditional form, at least in the West,
To note those last words, that the holy seed is in the stump, I think, it's important.
Yeah, and another good reason to read the whole passage, not just one.
Yes.
So Psalm 138. I'm handing over to you here, Howard, because you're the psalm guy.
Very briefly. It's a wonderful psalm of thanksgiving. It begins the last final sort of group of psalms that are attributed to David. It's a thanksgiving that sort of builds one thing upon another. He speaks very brilliantly, I think, in the beginning about praising God in the heavens and in front of the gods of the nations.
Mm.
And then you work your way down through three registers. He speaks about praising God in the presence of the gods. Then he talks about the kings of the earth praising God. And then finally about his own enemies being overcome. We're never quite sure what the psalmist is giving thanks for. We're not told really what has happened. But you have this sort of three registers, gods, kings, enemies. So whatever opposes the psalmist, be whatever seeks to express power over the psalmist, be they heavenly or earthly in whatever context and whatever power they may have on earth, he gives thanks to God in that context and maintains his faith. We also note that the psalm is wedged between 137, which is by the rivers of Babylon, that great psalm of exile, and 139, which is about God's personal examination of each of us. So there is a sort of sense of thanksgiving for something that's major, exile.
Yep.
But also this sense then of generating a relationship with God, which is really quite intimate and strong.
Mm. It's a lovely compliment to the Isaiah reading, isn't it?
Yes, and I think it goes beyond the Isaiah reading too, in a what you might call an eschatological sort of way. It sort of moves to a relationship with God that is not just dependent on earthly sort of circumstances.
Yep. Thank you. Welcome. So we're going to turn to the New Testament now, to 1 Corinthians 15:1-11. And it's worth saying for preachers who preach every week.
15, did you say? Or
15. 15. 1 Corinthians 15.
Oh, sorry. I'm jumping ahead.
For preachers who preach regularly, this is the first of 3 weeks in 1 Corinthians 15, which is a long chapter, where Paul really shifts, you know, in 1 Corinthians he's been dealing a lot with community division and other things. He's been talking in the previous passage about prophecy and giftedness. But now he moves to address a kind of a theological problem, which is there are some who do not believe in the resurrection of the body. And this is really a theological problem that has plagued Christianity for 2,000 mm-hmm. years. So a deeply important passage. And preachers might like to think whether you want to, if you do want to focus on Corinthians, it's a nice three-week series, although the other readings are also great this week too. So a couple of things to say here. The first sentence, he begins with, you know, again, we're getting some epiphanic language, like, I made known to you, brothers and sisters, and then this language that in the NRSV is kind of the good news is this gospel word, euangelion. So the gospel that I gospelized to you is literally what Paul writes here. And I love the mutuality because he talks about, you know, you received it and you now stand in it. There's a sense of it's not just that he gospelized, he preached it to them, but it was both received and is now lived in some way. And it is that leads to the verse 2 claim, through which you have been saved. And really in verses 3 and 4 here, we get just a lovely summary of the classic gospel message, which will eventually, you know, it's familiar to us because some of this language gets picked up in the creeds in the 3rd and 4th centuries, of died, risen, appeared. I just want to point out, Paul appeals here to a couple of sort of what I would call evidence. He talks about according to the scriptures. So for any Jews, and Corinthians was probably a mostly Gentile context, but for any Jews, he's talking about this is all in accordance with the scriptures. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, continuous with God's plan. And but he also uses eyewitnesses. So he goes through this long list of, you know, who Christ first appeared to. It was, you know, Peter, Cephas, then the 12, and then more than 500, you know, it's getting bigger and bigger. And then we get this amazing line. So the eyewitnesses are important as kind of this is true. But then we get where I think there is a link to the Isaiah reading here. He talks about Christ appearing to me, and that's a reference to that epiphanic encounter he had on the Damascus Road. To one untimely born is what the NRSV has. And the Greek word here is ektroma. It's a word that basically means an aborted fetus or a miscarriage, maybe a stillbirth. It gets used for any of those things in antiquity. So Paul is using it figuratively here, obviously, but to denote one who was kind of destined for death, had no means of survival. Perhaps it's a way to talk about himself being wretched, and so the resurrection is playing even in his own life. There's a sense that he only became fully human and alive when he encountered Christ, and so there's a metaphorical resurrection happening alongside his appeal to the resurrection.
Yes, but he's aware of his own humanity, his own vulnerability as an individual.
Yes, exactly. Context.
The other thing that sort of rings true in looking at this, comparing it with the Isaiah reading, is that in Isaiah we begin with the glory of God in this heavenly temple vision, but then how does that fill the earth? It fills the earth in Isaiah's words in that context.
Yes.
Here the resurrection, the message of the resurrection, new life, fills the earth through these witnesses who Paul cites and through his own words in that context.
Yeah, and it's not, I don't want to set preaching and prophecy in opposition to each other, but proclamation of the gospel becomes those words that fill, that do the same work. One of the things that came to mind for me is this would be a great week to sing the hymn Amazing Grace. I mean, I think every week's a great week to sing Amazing Grace. I do, I love it. But we get this hint here. Do I take it you don't love it?
Some of the other words about what a wretched soul I am, I think just...
Oh, see, I don't mind a bit of wretched soul. Because in verse 9 here, we get the sense that Paul is haunted, and he mentions this almost every time he mentions his calling and sort of conversion towards Christ, that he's unfit to be called an apostle because he persecuted the church. So there's a sense that he's haunted by his past sins. Yes. And it made me think of John Newton, who wrote Amazing Grace, who, you know, when he converted to Christianity, was haunted by his work as a slave trader and became an abolitionist. There's the sense that even in experiencing the profound grace of God, it doesn't mean those past actions entirely leave us. And in fact, I think for Paul, it drives him to make up for it in a sense. But we get that sort of profound moment of grace here was my connection.
That's all right. Not too much of the wretchedness.
No. I mean, a brief.
Our vulnerability, our humanity, our weaknesses as human beings.
Exactly.
Our limitations. Those are the things I think that are also wrapped up in this whole sort of notion of feeling of inadequacy.
Exactly. And I mean, I don't mean to condemn Paul. I think Paul was acting and persecuting the church as, you know, a faithful and zealous Jew, fully living what he believed was the right thing to do. So, So, again, themes here that connect about, you know, that vision of God. It's different here to Isaiah's vision in the temple, but, you know, Paul's vision, we know from other texts, is of a risen Christ that, again, is this encounter with the divine that is completely transformative but also leads to a calling.
He, like Isaiah, is talking about a message that's not going to be easily received, heard or seen, etc.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And he affirms them in their belief, which is where the passage ends in verse 11, but he's going to go on to unpack that a bit more fully in terms of that belief needs to include belief in the bodily resurrection, which we'll get to next week.
Did you know you could join our Facebook group, By the Well, for extra content and discussion?
So the gospel reading is Luke 5, 1 to 11, another what is traditionally seen as a call story, although I might want to suggest it's actually more of an epiphany as well in terms of Jesus revealing something. What did you notice in Luke 5?
Well,
or do you want a bit of context first? Would that be helpful?
Oh, yeah, if you can give a bit of New Testament context. I've got a question.
Okay. So we're early in the gospel here. Jesus, in chapter 4 of Luke, has started preaching, and in most of the previous chapter, he has actually been preaching in synagogues. He's done some healing as well, but he's been travelling around and doing a lot of work in synagogues. So in Luke's gospel, Jesus very much is presented as sort of starting within Judaism, got temple stories and things. And so chapter 4 ends with his continued proclamation of the message in the synagogues of Judea. But now we go to this public space. He's by the lake of Gennesaret. The crowd is literally pressing upon him. The language is quite sort of like they're leaning upon him almost. And so he gets into a boat to teach. We're never told what he teaches here. So in a sense, the teaching is not the point of the story. It's a setup for what follows. So anything you wanted to pick up?
Well, my question, I mean, obviously there's a link somehow to the end of John's gospel in terms of casting the net in a different place and gathering a whole lot of fish that these presumably smart fishermen would have been able to tell where the fish were
gathering. Right, yes.
But it all sounds so easy. If you just cast your net in the right place, everything will come. And that seems to me to be rub up against what is happening with Isaiah.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, and I mean, I get how if you just read this passage in isolation, it could look easy, but Simon Peter is going to discover that following Jesus isn't so easy and comes with cost and, you know, ultimate cost heading towards the cross, obviously, but... Yeah, I think one of the things I'd want to say, it's very easy to read this along with Matthew and Mark because they all have very similar call stories with fishermen and stuff. But what we don't have here is I'll make you fishers of men. That's never in this passage. Yeah. What we end up with is actually you know, follow me and from now on you'll be catching people. Yeah. And it's a different word used for catching fish. Yes. It's not a – so the language here is of earlier on it's like put down your nets and they kind of gathered up or captured, literally kind of – it's a word that's sometimes used for imprisonment. They captured the fish, enclosed them. And at the end in verse 10 it's, you know, from now on you'll be catching people alive – is literally the language. So we've moved a bit beyond fishiness. It's not about fish for people, which makes me think that the miraculous catch is not about fish at all. That image I don't think is working for Luke. I think the miraculous catch is about showing that Jesus is more than human, that these competent fishermen have fished all night, but Jesus knows where to get so much fish that two boats are sinking. This is the overabundance of God, maybe more than you want.
That's the sense I got out of it. It's not so much to do with the skill of the fisherman involved, to keep the metaphor going, but it's really about whether God in Jesus here is behind what's happening. I mean, ultimately he's the one who actually generates the catch.
yes. And Simon Peter, I mean, there are great similarities here to the Isaiah reading in many ways. When he sees the abundance of the catch, he falls down on his knees and says, "Go away from me, I'm a sinful man." So instead of unclean lips, it's framed here as sinfulness. Yeah. And we'll again get a reversal because within a couple of verses he goes from go away to leaving everything and following.
Well, it is literature.
Yes, exactly. It's a dramatic story. And what we don't have, unlike Isaiah, is actually a moment or a ritual of cleansing or forgiveness. It's just a call in his sinful state, which I think is kind of interesting. And one that will continue in Luke, where Jesus is criticized for hanging out with sinners and the woman that anoints him is called a sinner and the tax collectors are called sinners. So actually maybe one of the differences, if one was to preach this alongside Isaiah, is that we don't have any ritual action because that for Luke will come at the end in the cross and resurrection. It's that God actually calls people precisely in their sinfulness.
And Jesus' presence, continuing presence with those sort of people too.
So in our last couple of minutes, Howard, are there themes you want to draw together here for preachers? One of the things I thought about is There's a paradox in these readings, all three of the readings apart from the psalm, where encountering the glory or the manifestation of God does this paradoxical thing of convicting people of their own frailty, however that's framed, sinfulness, uncleanliness, wretchedness, but at the same time of their worthiness because they're called.
Yes.
Like... Yeah. But and is there anything else that struck you or you want to unpack
struck me,
that?
I mean, I have to preach on these readings in a few weeks' time at my local church. And, I mean, the one thing I've been tossing around is you're preaching, in my context, to a church that's ageing and struggling in some ways, still doing all right, but there's a question of hope, especially at the end of Isaiah and in the resurrection story itself. And I think that's important to... I mean, often these people just don't know where to throw their net, to speak like that. You know? What do you change? What do you do within the church that might, you know, bring others in and help them? And I think it's a different sort of thing. It's a continuing to live as faithful people in this context, even if things seem to be, well, pretty dire in that context.
And there's perhaps a word of comfort there too that... Again, you know, as we commented on earlier, in all of these readings, the active agent is God. So our human call is to respond to God, to remain faithful, to not perhaps let our feelings of frailty stop us from living into the gospel. But ultimately it is God's activity, not reliant on our human skill or endeavour.
And often we do reduce it to our own skill and endeavour. I mean, should we change the music that we sing in church? Should we change the gear that we're dressed in, the words that we use, etc.? It's not about that. It's about faithfulness in that context.
Well, thank you for listening, everyone.
By the Well is brought to you by Pilgrim Theological College and the Uniting Church in Australia. It's produced by Adrian Jackson. Thanks for listening.